Night Media Studios and Paranormal Underground Magazine. Welcome to Paranormal Underground Radio. It's time to explore the unexplained with your hosts, Rick Hale and Karen Frazier.
The music went away early. Oh no, there it is.
There it is.
Our music disappeared. I got worried.
No, I think we're on now, Karen. Hey, everybody. Welcome to
I knew we were on.
Welcome to another Thursday of Paranormal Underground Radio. I'm your host, Rick Hale, and I am here right now with Karen. She is riding shotgun tonight. How you doing, Karen?
Shotgun. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Tonight we have a pretty good show. Bill Murphy is joining us to talk about his investigations on the Sci-Fi Channel TV series Fact or Fake, The Paranormal Files. He'll also fill us in on what's next for the show, new gear he's been working with, and his longtime paranormal investigations. Bill's fascination with experimental electronics developed for the purpose of ITC research has led to him documenting paranormal events for nearly 20 years. Being a guest on various radio shows and webcasts has allowed him to share what he has learned so others may maximize their own experience. His projects and appearances have been broadcast on the Biography Channel, Discovery, and ABC News. Fact or Faked Paranormal Files has generated strong ratings since its debut. The series strives to validate or refute videos of mysterious events through experiments and field investigations. Bill's independently released work is available through www.ghosttown.tv. Good evening, Bill Murphy. How are you?
I am fine. And how are you guys?
Pretty
great.
Good.
Hey, I also wanted to thank you for coming on show night. I understand that you have the series finale, not the series finale. That would be the end of the show forever. The season finale tonight, is that correct?
It's actually a mid-season finale. Yes.
Okay, and so it's they do it like they do, and where it'll come back in a few months.
Yeah, we start shooting again. Oh shoot, I gotta leave this weekend. And it starts airing again early November, so you'll see a whole new batch of episodes.
Cool.
Great. Well, Bill, I got to tell you the truth, buddy. I love this show. I think it's one of the best television shows in the paranormal genre right now. And, you know, I really enjoyed this, first half of the season, and I can't wait until the second half. It really is a wonderful piece of work.
Well, thanks. I mean, on behalf of everybody associated with the show, we all take that as a big compliment. It's a lot of hard work that goes into doing it, but, you know, we're keeping it real. We're doing it as we think it should be done, and we're having a blast doing it.
I imagine that you are. Analyzing videos that are all over YouTube right now, which I would probably say maybe anywhere from 75% to 85% of those videos are fake, and you guys have the opportunity to really take a look at those and either prove them or disprove them. So I say kudos to you guys. It's a great show.
And it's something that's really, really necessary, I think, too, because a lot of people believe everything they see on YouTube. And I think we all know that, you know, a little education goes a long way.
Yeah, you know, what we do in the show is what a lot of people do at home anyway. I mean, with the exception of we go out and we try to recreate the original video as close to it as we possibly can. So I think most people can relate to a bunch of friends sitting around somebody's house, looking at YouTube videos, or maybe even just by yourself, and you make comments to them. You don't necessarily always go online and make comments about them, but you make a judgment call on the spot. Well, before we make a judgment, we kind of pause for a bit, and we debate the merits of it. And sometimes what we think a video should look like isn't what it is at all. Who's to say what a ghost would really look like? Let's just use a haunting for an example. Nobody knows what a ghost really looks like. And so we take all of them under consideration, and we act upon the ones that meet several criteria.
Well, I just think that, anybody who says that they believe and see everything they hear is just a person who's committing intellectual suicide. I'm sure you would agree with that, correct, Bill?
To say all of them are real? Well, sure. I mean, you can't do that. And that's not necessarily what YouTube is about. It's not necessarily presenting accurate news for many people. It's about putting up a video to showcase their work, for example. If somebody is a computer graphic artist, which is something that I pursued for years myself, graphics and how to simulate.
Right.
Well, you know, Bill,
we're having a delay problem, I think. So if we talk over you, Bill, I'm sorry. We seem to be having a little bit of a delay problem with the audio. Hopefully, it'll just sort of work itself out in a few minutes. But if we talk over you, I do apologize.
Right. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Okay. Sure. No problem. I didn't hear you guys talk over me. I'm not sure if that's how it's playing out on the air because I have my computer speakers turned down.
Sure. Sure.
Okay.
Okay. So let's go ahead and talk about some of your experiences. We have lots of questions for you, so let's get started.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. I mean, I'm sure everybody out there who's not familiar with you, Bill, would like to know more about you. So, I mean, you know, the question that we like to ask, you know, anybody who's involved with paranormal research or investigation, what exactly led you into the field of paranormal investigation?
I grew up all around it. I mean, I'm from New Orleans, where I was born, where I was raised. It's where I went to school and finished college before I moved to California. And for me, hearing the tales, like, throughout the city, but more importantly, hearing the stories going on within my own family and in the family home is something that sort of drove me to want to document some of these claims.
Right.
And I use the word claims because I can only characterize these as being an indirect experience because while I was living there and while I was growing up in my parents' house, I didn't necessarily see what visitors to our house would see. As a matter of fact, only one person in my family ever reported seeing this particular phenomena that was reoccurring happen in the house. It was people who didn't live there and were visiting who were reporting something. It wasn't until I moved away and came back that's when I realized, wait a second, there is something going on in this house. And I decided, let me see if I can get this on tape or recorded one way or another.
Right.
So what was going on?
The only way I can describe it would be poltergeist activity.
Really?
And other people were seeing what they thought was a small animal moving through the house. Where the house was carpeted, there was like a marble entry, and then some rooms were carpeted and other rooms were hardwood floors. And people were saying, there's a dog or something, something just ran by. And we didn't have any pets in the house, but there was like oatmeal colored carpet. The marble in the entryway was blonde colored. And so people would see something scoot by, but living in a house, none of us ever did. But visitors would.
Mm-hmm.
And it always seemed to follow the same path in the house. So the only other person who said anything about there being something in the house that none of us were seeing was my grandmother. And it was characterized as, they thought maybe it was a witch. They didn't have any other way to describe it. It says, is there a witch here? So
really?
I found that to be kind of humorous growing up, because there was also the tales of the supernatural making my way around town, making my way in the city of New Orleans. You hear that, and it just sort of, there's so many layers to the paranormal in my hometown that, being that I grew up with it, to be honest with you, I was afraid I was getting a little jaded to the notion of it.
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Well, New Orleans has got to be an amazing place for anybody who actually has an interest in the paranormal, I would imagine.
Yeah, and even if you don't and you go there, you know, you're going to learn about it when you get there, because, simply because it's cornerstone of the history of the city. And it just continues to build upon its legacy with new events happening all the time.
Right.
New Orleans is a place that really shouldn't be there. I mean, it's below sea level. It's ringed with levees. Everybody knows what happened when the levees breached in 2005
yeah.
with Katrina. And,
right.
you know, that just added yet another layer of what New
right.
Orleans is being built on.
Right,
yeah.
right. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing place. I've never been there. It's on my list of places that I'd like to go. My folks were there a few years ago, right before Katrina, as a matter of fact, and they said it was absolutely an incredible place. So it's some place I'd definitely like to visit. So,
go ahead. I have to just add one thing about New Orleans. As a resident of the city, we used to really tempt fate. So when a hurricane was coming and there were hurricane warnings, people would go to the levee, and you stand up there on the levee with these, you know, these winds were coming, the clouds were dark, it was swirling in the distance. You knew that it was dangerous, and you would toast to the wind. And we always felt like there was something that was somewhat protecting the city. Unfortunately, the luck ran out, but there is a drink available at Pat O'Brien's. It's called the Hurricane, and it's just in honor of the fact that New Orleans has defied the odds for a long, long time. It did catch up to the city, but it's still there today.
It has survived, definitely. So I kind of wanted to change track a little bit, because one of the things that I'm really interested in is ITC research, and I know you've been pretty actively involved in that. So I wanted you to tell me a little bit about your research with ITC.
It kind of, for me, goes back to when I was a kid. I was doing something with my father's World War II metal shortwave radio. It was huge. I mean, the thing was, you know, probably about 18 inches wide and, you know, maybe 9 inches tall, and it was deep, and it was a big, heavy, well-built shortwave radio from the
mm-hmm.
army.
Mm-hmm.
And that was put in one of the spare bedrooms upstairs, and I used to go in that room by myself, close the door, open the window, turn on the radio, and I was sweeping the band with the radio back then. I was just looking up into the sky at the stars.
Really?
And I would sweep the band. I would try to go in between stations. I was doing what people had been doing for quite a while, which I didn't realize, that swept tune radio communication has been an activity that paranormal enthusiasts have done for many, many, well, many decades, actually, going back to the early 70s. For me, this was going on in the 60s when I started doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a blast doing it. I was always wondering, what could I tune in? What could I hear that's distant? You know, I knew from doing that I was surrounded all the time with energy that I couldn't see, I couldn't necessarily feel, but under the right circumstances, I could get in touch with. And that experience as a kid growing up kind of brought me to where we are today with IFTC, where, you know, now there's a lot of automated swept tune radio devices such as Frank's Box and Shack Hacks and whatever you think of those things, because it's, I can certainly understand why people are dismissive of that form of ITC. But whatever your opinion is of it, it has changed the current face of paranormal investigation. A lot of tune radios. So my story.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
We're back into the 50s. And so when I first heard of Frank, because I was sort of trolling the ITC forums, you know, when they first started to appear a few years back, that's when I established a dialogue with Frank, and I went to meet him in Colorado very early on when he only had a couple of them, and he gifted me with a Frank's Box then and several more as the years have gone by, and we've stayed in touch. And but it wasn't just that. It was also video feedback loop ITC is something else that's always intrigued me.
Yeah, the video feedback is interesting.
Yeah. It's really neat how it creates a loop.
Yeah, and to those that aren't familiar with it, you know, I'll just very briefly describe it for any of the listeners that aren't familiar with video feedback loop. But you take a camera, you point it at a monitor, you take a cable and you plug it into the video out of the camera, and you plug that into the video in jack on the back of the monitor. Now, with the camera pointed at the monitor, yet you're feeding the signal into the monitor, it creates one of those infinite mirror effects that happens, like the old funhouse infinite mirror where the reflections go on to infinity. Well, in this case, it's an electronic feedback. And then when you get the focus just right on the camera, which is generally going to be just into the face of the front of your monitor, it begins this sort of strobing effect. And it can kind of become a little hypnotic if you're not careful, but it can certainly take over the ambience of a room. But in that process of this strobing effect, you can begin recording with the same camera. Just put a tape in, hit record. And you don't want to do it for very long. You just got a few minutes. And when you play the tape back, you'd be surprised at the it's been captured in the video feedback loop. And sometimes these are images that seem to reveal a relevance to any questions you may choose to ask during the session.
I was going to just say, I've seen, I've looked a lot because we interviewed Mark Macy in the past, who of course is a big ITC researcher. And so I've spent some time on his site looking at some of the things that they've captured from that video ITC. And some of it is almost stunning. It's got to go beyond matrixing because it's just too clear.
You know, you brought up a really good point. I mean, you would hope it goes beyond pareidolia, also known as matrixing, but it, the process itself can be self-corrupting because you're looking for patterns in the noise. And that also applies to swept tune radios. It applies to everything that we're doing in ITC. So you know, you have to really exercise caution and really work hard to discern what is the natural tendency to make a pattern from noise and what may be a legitimate image. So it's a hit and miss process. And I'm not saying it always works. And I engage in this process because I enjoy doing it, but it's not something that I would say take the evidence that we get from an ITC session and tell somebody to make a life decision based off of it.
Right. So do you think that in some ways ITC is, like, especially the video feedback ITC, or I've seen people who, like, take pictures of flames and stuff, and to me, some of that almost seems like scrying, you know, or gazing into a crystal ball where you start to see things. And so I wonder, is there some element, do you think, where of scrying in some of the ITC methods that people try as well?
Yes, I do. That's exactly what I think it is. I'm so glad you said that, because that is what I believe is happening. In many of these cases, people are obtaining messages that are already in their own subconscious. So the patterns that they're recognizing are the patterns that they already have right there at the tip of their conscious. It's something they're already thinking, they're already feeling, and maybe they're intuitive, and they're hanging on to the messages that make sense to them. So it's like a self-validation process.
Right.
You know, it really took a long time for a lot of people to accept EVP. I mean, even it took a while for me. And do you think that the ITC is, you know, pretty much the electronic voice phenomena of the future?
As the instrumentation evolves, I would kind of hope so. I'd like to quote, you know, a friend of mine, Scotty. He said, thousands of years ago, we were surrounded by oxygen. Our very existence proves that fact. Yet we had no way of knowing oxygen was even in the atmosphere, much less a way of detecting it and measuring it. Now we can measure it very, very precisely, and we know everything that's in the air around us. So we are surrounded by all sorts of energies, and if science continues to evolve, they'll continue to have additional breakthroughs. So maybe something based off of ITC as we know it today will lead to a breakthrough that we can all be then appreciate today's version of ITC.
Right.
Yeah, okay. It's a fascinating topic, and I know that's not what you came to discuss, but I just couldn't let it go while you were here because it's sort of one of my favorite subjects. So thank you for indulging me. I really appreciate that.
I appreciated the questions because it's one of my favorite subjects too. I don't get enough opportunity to continue to do it all the time. I did it more often and I did it with groups, and I don't like to let people know what my perceptions are or what happens in the session. I like to poll other people and see what they're getting. I don't let anybody know what the other person says that they saw or heard. And then I look at the data afterwards and I try to see if everybody is arriving at a similar conclusion.
You know, I said I was done, and I'm sorry, I'm wrong. I have one more question. And that's that when somebody has, in your opinion, when somebody has a piece of audio evidence, how do you suggest they go about analyzing it and deciding whether it's a valid piece of evidence, whether it should be discounted, whether it's kind of goes in the maybe, and that people go about that process?
By audio evidence, are you referring to electronic voice phenomena?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of that goes in how you proceed with your EVP session in the first place. What I prefer to do, when at all possible, but it isn't always, I like having a camera with a wide angle capturing everything going on in the room.
Right.
Because there is, you know, the strong possibility, particularly in a public venue, that you're simply getting somebody else speaking, somebody else maybe whispering, and the person doing the recording isn't hearing it. It may be below that individual's threshold for hearing, but the microphone is more sensitive and it can pick it up. But with that said, you know, I've done some EVP sessions where I really try to check. I did this with Anita, and you guys, Cheryl, you spoke to Anita because she set this interview up today, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, definitely. Anita was really helpful.
It's like we set up a controlled environment because we wanted to test a new piece of gear and see how it could possibly help. And I was thinking, wait a second, how could we get this kind of an EVP this clearly? I mean, I looked at her, she looked at me, and we were flabbergasted. So, I mean, EVPs are a real phenomenon. I don't have an explanation because they appear to be recorded non-acoustically. And we recorded that session with a video camera, and on the recorder, the voices were heard.
Well, I mean, spirits, they don't exactly have lungs to breathe and vocal cords. So it's really just no clear-cut explanation for it.
Well, I can't even come to the conclusion that it's a spirit that's leaving the voice. What about the thought projection from one of the people involved in the EVP session?
Yeah, that's a great question, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's actually what drives me forward in this subject, in this study of research. What drives me forward is how is the media getting on your recorder in the first place? What is the mechanism behind it? How are you getting photos of things that don't appear in the room any other way? And I have examples of that. How are EVPs landing on there? I mean, there's a certain mind-matter interaction that occurs all the time. And is that part of the process? Because nothing is ever making direct contact with anything else. All the particles that make up you, me, and the phones that we're holding are suspended away from each other. Everything
right.
is in this jelly-like electromagnetic field, never making a contact. You can drop a cannonball from the Empire State Building, and the sidewalk will crack, yet they never make contact.
Right.
And that means everything is being interacted. You are affecting the physical world all the time. So what is... Who are we to say that you can't scale that phenomena up and say
right.
it doesn't have to be on a subatomic level? Maybe
right.
it is on a molecular level. Maybe it's larger than that. Keep scaling it up. Maybe you can affect items that you can see in the room. You can push them with what you think is your hand, but maybe it's more thought.
Right.
Anyway,
You're right along the thought processes that I like to chase along when I lay in bed at night and can't sleep and you start thinking about things. That's the type of stuff I like to think about. I don't know what that says about me, but hey, I'm right there with you.
I can't turn my brain off with that kind of stuff either.
Well, and you know, here's the thing is that what if it is a thought projection as opposed to a ghost voice? Is that any less remarkable? I don't think it is. I think it's still pretty darn remarkable.
Oh, absolutely.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, sorry, go ahead, Karen.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. You know, Bill, there's something that I always like to ask, you know, fellow paranormal investigators. My wife, she gets kind of afraid of me coming up against something that, you know, I either might not be able to handle or might be a little too much for me, whatever. Have you ever had anything that has negatively, you know, impacted your life, or are you afraid that you will one day come up against something that, I don't know, may throw you into, you know, a mental asylum or something?
Well, I don't know if any bad luck that I've had or any events that have occurred that I wish haven't been either a result of bad decision making
mm-hmm.
on my part or being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I can't attribute anything negative that's happened to me to my involvement in paranormal research. I just can't correlate the two. If I could, then maybe I would have to, you know, take a step back and reconsider what I've been doing for decades now. But
right.
as it stands now, no, I really I mean the worst thing that has happened to me in researching the paranormal is getting a really bad scrape in my arm when I put my arm in a hole in the wall because I
mm-hmm.
wanted to see if I could feel the wall that was missing.
Right.
And when I did, I misjudged and I scraped myself. So was that like an entity cutting me? No, that was me just, you know, contacting the wood.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing this since I was 8 years old. I'm 36, and I would have to say that I've probably dealt with quite a bit. I've been pushed and shoved, punched, kicked, well, you know, what feels like that, and I've even received a scratch once or twice. So that's just a question that I like to ask, you know, fellow investigators every now and then to see if they have those same kind of experiences.
Well, I mean, to kind of address what you're saying specifically, I have been at locations and I felt what I thought at the time was physical contact by an outside force. However,
mm-hmm.
as I looked deeper into it, if you guys want me to go into this, I'll go into it. I can try to make it as short and concise as I possibly can.
Totally. Go into it, yeah.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. It's kind of the basis of what I did my third documentary on, the Stanley effect, of what happened there. At the Stanley, people talk about being touched, pushed, and, you know, they attribute it to a woman who used to work. Actually, no, she didn't work there. It was a woman who broke in to the Stanley in the winter for shelter and died under the concert hall there. So there's a room there that says she was found, and then people report you can feel her touching you. And
mm-hmm.
when I went to the Stanley, I was even getting those kind of reports from other people that were attending the conference that I was at. And I was actually taping the conference. I had cameras set up in different places, and I was taping some of the speakers and some of the experiences of the attendees and such. And as I was kind of, you know, just making my way through the hotel, I went down this little small flight of stairs that goes from the lobby area to the hallway on the first floor. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the layout of the Stanley, but there's a little elevator there. And as I walked by it, it was like I had a bunch of cell phones set to vibrate in all kinds of pockets that I didn't even have in my clothes. I felt this vibration on my body.
Really?
And I backed up, and I went, wait a second, is this what people are reporting? Because there was a physical sensation there. And I backed up, and it didn't happen a second time. But I continued with almost like 5, 6 times after completely documentary. It did happen a second time, and I thought to zero in on what's occurring. There's a phenomenon called the piezoelectric effect.
Mm-hmm.
The Stanley is built on granite, which is infused with quartz, like most granite is, in various degrees. There's a fair amount of quartz in the granite dome under the Stanley Hotel. There's also, just off the hill, the power plant that Stanley built. So when I was going there, shooting this documentary, they were actually in the process of rewiring the Stanley, because they have what's called ground leaks. They have, it's not a common ground. They have various sockets going to copper pipes that's hammered into the ground. So they didn't have three-prong wiring in a lot of the hotel. They have a common ground. It had two conductors, and then you ground the negative. Well, that causes this arcing across hallways. And so you have a EMF detector, and you're going to get, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11 milligauss in the hallway, certain hallways, and Mariner House included. And so you had this high EMF field, you had this overcharged hotel, you had these power lines coursing right through the granite, going up into the bottom of the hotel, branching out like tree limbs. And what was happening, it appears that the piezoelectric properties of the quartz is also happening in people's bodies, because both of them, the human skeleton and all animals and quartz, share the same properties. And here's what the piezoelectric property does. If you take quartz and you compress it or apply pressure to it, you stress it in any way, it discharges electricity, and it's measurable. And it's instantly rechargeable. It does it again over and over. And as long as you're stressing it, it emits voltage. Well, the opposite is true. If you electrify quartz, it changes shape. Well, the human skeleton does the same thing. If you energize a skeleton, there's minute shape changes. So what I think is going on at the Stanley and probably other locations, it isn't that you're being pushed by an external force. It's an internal skeletal shape change under the skin, and you're feeling it. And the only way you can understand it is to say, I was touched.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that is interesting.
You know, Bill, we wanted to, you know, talk about the show, of course, a little bit. You know, tell us about this, you know, new show, you know, Fact or Faked, Paranormal Files, and, you know, how did you join the show? Because, you know, like I said, people are really digging on this program.
And I'm glad they're enjoying it. I really am. We're working really hard to deliver what we think is, you know, a really accurate look at paranormal phenomena. But the way I got on it, to answer your question, is when I was introduced through a colleague, because some of the people involved in the show, I kind of thought that I was being introduced because perhaps some of my footage was going to be licensed from me, because I have done a few pieces, and it ended up being aired on other paranormal shows, paranormal team broadcast. And I kind of thought that at first, but then I learned right away that they wanted to know more about my own work and my own research and the experiments that I love doing. I like taking an audience, a lot of people, and subjecting everybody to something that's kind of crazy so I can look at the data. And when they brought me in, they introduced me to some of the people that were going to be working on the show, and one of them was Ben Hansen, who's a former FBI agent, is the team leader. And so we all met, and we went out, we had a bite to eat, and we struck up an immediate dialogue. And that rapport continued. The show had a fairly long gestation period before they even shot a pilot. And they shot the pilot, they tweaked the formula a little bit, and they asked if I would remain a part of the show. And to me, it was a really good fit to what I was already doing before.
Right.
And but I wasn't investigating this way. I was doing this as far as experimentation. But as far as investigating, I was always trying to gather my own evidence. This show takes existing evidence and we try to replicate it. So that's how that's how I got on. It was really meeting the people, and the chemistry was right.
Great. So do you mind taking some questions from the chat room, Bill?
I'm glad to do it, because just an FYI to anybody in the chat room, I'm not looking at the chat room, because then I'll stop listening.
Right.
And
now I got them here. Reading. Yeah.
Okay,
thank you. I've got them here. So the first one is that somebody, Boxmouth Beaver wants to know more about the Ghostwriter investigation.
That was a good case. Can I preface it a little bit, why I brought this case?
Definitely.
Please do.
All right. Now, this goes back when I was young, but the photograph remained in my parents' house and just until about 6 years ago. And then it's been displaced, unfortunately. I really wish I had it. But a close acquaintance of my family had indicated that her life was going to be ending very soon. And people make remarks, and some people feel they feel doom is coming, but she made this remark. She let it be known to everybody. Well, she went to a dinner party, and they snapped Polaroid of somebody at the dinner party, and she was in the Polaroid. Now, her image was stretched out with this sort of white, misty shape of her body hovering over her and the other people in the dinner party. And it was always a really unusual picture, and I always, asked, what happened with this picture? Why is it just her? Well, 2 days later, she died. So I wondered, how did that happen? What did this photograph actually capture? So when I learned about Ghostwriter, I actually tracked this case for a number of years, and I pursued the homeowners to see if we could turn this into an episode, tell their story. But they knew beforehand that we'd be going in there, and we would be trying to replicate it if we could. And so that is how the case came about. So to answer the question, I believe it was, what do I think of the case? I find it to be still an amazing case that there's no satisfactory explanation to how it happened. We tried to replicate it. So for all practical purposes, the case is still open.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the most fascinating cases, that I've ever read about. Another fascinating one is I used to work with a guy who was from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and he knew about my interests, and he, told me about the Paulding lights. What exactly do you think those are? Do you think that those are static discharges from the earth, ghost lights, or corpse candles, as they call them over in Great Britain? What exactly are your thoughts on the Paulding lights?
Well, what I wanted to really have happen, well, it's what I believe. It's not like what I wanted to have happen. It's what I suspected, that maybe this is just a natural phenomenon. And I said that even during the making of the show, that there must be something unidentified. But what we do on the show, our mandate is to do one thing, one thing only, and that's to try to replicate the video. So we use the techniques and the steps that other people have posted or proposed, because that's actually just part of the scientific method of doing your research.
Of course.
So we looked at what other people have done, and they say it explains it, and we followed those steps. And we did more than an episode had time to show, because it takes days to do an episode, and they only show for minutes, really, on screen.
Right.
So you don't see how exhaustive the method that we followed to try to see if we could replicate the lights. And we couldn't get a car in the proper position. The airplane, which is like in the theory, That one I have my doubts about, simply because an airplane is moving, and you know it would need to be hovering for a long time.
Right.
And we thought about a Mirage, and the problem with a Mirage, there have to be certain atmospheric conditions, and those conditions aren't met year-round. So the light is seen year-round, so that sort of defeats that one. So we don't know what that one is. I mean, it's one that's going to have to, you know, until we can replicate it, we can't just say, here it is. We figured it out, because we couldn't. And also could be a combination of things. I mean, sometimes, you know, the lights on that Highway 45, you would think they'd be visible as, you know, little tiny headlights and taillights. But that's not what that Paulding light would look like. That thing would become huge.
Well, so, it's like, I apologize, Bill. Please continue.
No, that's okay. I can go on forever. You need to stop me.
Oh, no, I was just going to say that it's also like that, of course, with the Marfa lights in Texas and the Brown Mountain lights in, I think that's North or South Carolina. I can't remember which, but, you know, I personally am of the mind that it is not a headless miner searching for his head or whatever. I do think that it has something to do with a as of yet unknown naturally occurring Earth process. So I'm pretty much with you on that.
But, you know, there's dozens of those around the world. You named a few. We covered the one, but they're all over the place. And sometimes they're in the middle of just heavily wooded areas. So this one was on a, you know, you can get to it from the road, but you can't actually reach any point, because if you remember the episode where Jael and Austin jumped in the ATV and they went down that road, and they end up getting out and they're going, we don't see it. And I was looking at it from my vantage point. Well, they couldn't go any further because that road dead ends at a little river. And so that took it as far as it could go. They had to turn around and come back.
You know, Bill, there's something that, you know, I'm curious about, and I'm sure as well as, you know, anybody else listening or whatever. When you guys look at the YouTube questions, have you ever had, you know, gotten any angry emails from people saying, hey, man, this is legit, I'm telling you right now? Have you ever had anything like that? And if so, I mean, how do you deal, or, you know, your producers for that matter, how do you guys deal with that kind of thing?
Well, they have to get clearances on all the videos. So the people that are contacted by the show know that we're going to fall on the side of the fence that we feel logic takes us.
Right.
So, you know, we're not trying to out anybody that has never been the purpose of the show. It's all about validating the video. So that's our focus, not on the person, but on the video itself. So we don't want to call people out. I mean, you know, it's like if you have a video, you've shot it, it's unexplained, send it to us. Or if you post it, maybe we'll find it. And if it's something that meets the three criteria of the show, and the three criteria are, it's got to be a compelling video, it has to have an available witness, and it has to be testable. You know, can we replicate? Can we reasonably replicate this video?
Right.
Because
there's
other videos that we wanted to do, but they were shot from space shuttle and satellites, and they're out of space, and so we can't necessarily do that so easily.
Right.
You know, I think my favorite video that I've seen on the show, and I've never actually seen it on YouTube or Paratube or anything of that nature, is the where they're having the big bonfire, and all of a sudden you see whatever it is jumping from behind the tree. I mean, yeah, it kind of looks like a, you know, a 7-foot guy or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I really liked, you know, how you guys handled that one. It's like, oh, yeah, this is definitely, you know, a person. I mean, do you really believe that was a person, or could it be something unexplained?
Oh, I mean, like a cryptid, some sort of an animal that has not yet been identified. I guess it's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, we were mixed on it, and that's actually part of what we enjoy about the show. We don't necessarily always agree on what something is that we're looking at on the video. So if we can come to a rough consensus, you know, we very well may go and look at any of the videos that we've already shown before. but you know, YouTube right. has tens of thousands of new postings every single day, so the material is always being uploaded.
Right. So, I know that you just got the green light to shoot some more episodes of Fact or Fakes. What can you tell us about what's coming up? And also, can you tell us what's coming up tonight? At least give us a little preview.
Oh, sure. Tonight, by the way, is going to be great. As mentioned at the beginning of the show, it is the mid-season finale, and the case that Ben and his team are working on, it's called Indiana Cemetery, I believe is what they're calling it. And it's a great case. It's one that I kind of would have really enjoyed being on, but they were very, very thorough. They did a good job. They uncovered something that was quite surprising when we watched it in the Situation Room, because that is the unveiling for the rest of the team, is when we bring in the evidence that we have and we play it for the other team. They got something there that... Mm-hmm. It actually made me get out of my seat and go towards that big plasma screen to just put my nose over to it and hit
cool.
play again, because I need to see this a little better.
Yeah, those are great, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a really good case that Ben has. The case that I led was the cattle mutilations, and it's a big group.
Oh.
You know, so if somebody is not comfortable looking at that kind of footage, you know, you've been forewarned. Cattle mutilations happen. There's you know, tens of about 60,000 unsolved cases currently right now in the U.S.
Wow.
They haven't been able to make any arrests. The witnesses haven't come forth, and so it is a bit of a mystery. And you know, we go after that case with all guns blazing, trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I think it's kind of highly unlikely that the minions of Satan are actually performing these cattle mutilations.
Is that the current theory?
Well, that's one of the theories.
Yeah. Okay, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I got another question for you, Bill. When you guys did your post-Katrina investigations, did you guys run into any kind of, you know, resistance from the citizens of New Orleans or, you know, in that general area?
Well, the short answer is no.
Okay.
The long answer is that I was concerned about that. And my colleagues in California were saying, you know, are you sure this is in good taste? Well, originally the idea wasn't necessarily to go do a paranormal investigation. Originally, mm-hmm. we were going there to shoot post-Katrina, because it's my hometown. But the
right.
stories were coming right back to us about people who lost family members and pets and people that they knew, and saying they still feel their presence there, you know, in their homes. They're still in the city. They haven't been found. They're washed away, whatever the case may be. And so it turned almost from the beginning into what it was. And once we got there, and I had a crew with me, the people were just coming up to us in droves and telling mm-hmm. us their stories. Some people thought that maybe we were the news and they would be able to get a message out. And we had said, well, no, we're not news. We're not CNN. We're doing a documentary. It's an independent piece about the residual effect on a paranormal level of New Orleans, how it's been affected by Katrina. And then they had their stories. And so there was no shortage at all of people that wanted to tell us their stories. And we got a lot of stuff in that one.
Wow. So I have a question from the chat room. Ghost Hunter 50 wanted to know what you think an actual real video of a ghost would look like.
It's possible to know that. I mean, it's, you know, it's. I wish I knew.
I think that's a good answer. That's probably the same answer I would give, to tell you the truth. So we only have a few minutes left, because I know that you need to get going, because your show's on tonight. And so can you tell us what is coming up next for you, along with, I know that you're doing more episodes of Fact or Fake, but is there other stuff that you have in the hopper as well?
I do have other stuff. I have other documentaries that are in various stages of production, but my attention really has turned to Dr. Pig Paranormal Files right now. And, you know, we've got some international cases that we're going to be tackling right away. And so these cases, they get they keep amping it up. And I have to keep my attention there so I don't dilute my focus.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But you know what? There is another piece that hopefully, you know, between seasons, I'll be able to finish. And that one is going to be on manifesting thought forms.
Oh, cool. You'll have to let us know if you get that done and where we can find it, because that's, like I say, that's one of the ones that I sort of think is interesting.
It would end up being on the ghosttown.tv site, and it's already shot. So it's in an early stage of post right now.
Oh, great. Okay. All right. So show is tonight. It's the mid-season, and it airs on Sci-Fi at 9, 10. 10?
10?
It's 10, but they repeated them. So even if you miss the 10, I think there's a, you know, in the past they were showing it again at midnight. I'm not sure if they'll continue doing that or if it's a past episode they're going to show at midnight. But 10 mm-hmm. o'clock is the new episode for the first time.
Can people also get episodes on like Hulu or sci-fi.com or anything like that if they've missed them?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, all five of the current ones are on sci-fi.com.
Great.
Right now. So you can see them on there. You know, less commercial breaks. And, you know, it's a tighter format to see it on there, and it's a great way to do it, and also on Hulu. And for those whose internet connections don't necessarily support the bandwidth that both those sites require, some people even cut them up, and they've been on YouTube. So you can see, you know, what normally would be a one stream as five separate clips.
Okay.
Well, you know what, Bill? You're a fascinating cat, and, you know, it's a really great show. And we just wanted to say thank you very much. For being on, you know, our little part of the paranormal world. And, you know, we can't wait to see more from you in the future, especially in the next month's magazine. Is that correct, Cheryl?
Yeah, we will have Bill on the cover next month, September 2010, Paranormal Underground Magazine, and he'll mm-hmm. be our investigator spotlight.
Great.
So
well, thank
can
you
read
very
more
much again, then. Bill, and you know, good luck on the show, and good luck with everything you do in the future. You're doing great work,
and we hope you'll come back, Bill.
Yes.
Oh well, thank you. Yes, I'd love to come back. I really enjoyed being here, and a quick hello to Andy out of Oklahoma, who's there in the chat room.
And, shout out to Andy. Whoa.
There you go.
Yep.
All right.
Well, thank you, Bill.
Enjoy the show, and I'll look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
All right, folks, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Good night.
Pleasure is all ours.
Good night.
Okay, guys, we're going to go to break, and when we come back, we'll do the first part of our show because we had a little different schedule tonight, so we're going to go to break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Hi, this is Karen Frazier, author of Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, a new book from Ghost Night Media. In summer of 2009, I visited Wellington, Washington, a former railroad town in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State, where the worst avalanche disaster in the history of the United States occurred. 96 people lost their lives. What I found there changed my life forever. Before I visited Wellington, I wasn't sure that I believed in ghosts or even in the human soul. Now I know for sure that ghosts are real and that our souls go on after we die. You can read all about my experiences at Wellington in my new book, Avalanche of Spirits, The Ghosts of Wellington, which is on sale at Amazon.com. To learn more, visit avalancheofspirits.com.
Hi, I'm Chad Wilson, publisher and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
And I'm Cheryl Knight, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Paranormal Underground Magazine.
Every month, Paranormal Underground explores the unexplained with a free monthly online magazine.
We take an in-depth look at all kinds of unexplained phenomena, talk with some of the field's top experts, and share the latest news and information about the paranormal.
Visit us at ParanormalUnderground.net, where you can read the magazine online, explore our paranormal evidence galleries, watch videos, participate in discussions, or read blogs with some of our writers and editors.
We hope you'll join us. Visit ParanormalUnderground.net and explore the unexplained.
The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of ZTalk Radio, its affiliates, or sponsors.
Station identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency
on ZTalkRadio.com.
And we're back. So, hey, that was pretty interesting, wasn't it, Rick?
I would say that was probably one of the more fascinating interviews we've had so far. Him and, Stan, which I'm going to say, if Stan is listening, I owe him an apology. I'm reading the book right now, and
what?
I'm finding it to be believable. It's
Cheryl!
Hard for me to say.
I told you, Rick. I told you.
And finding it to be believable. Now, It's a stretch for me, but I understand, you know, the concept of high strangeness, and there's definitely high strangeness in that cat's life. So,
yeah.
But yeah, definitely, the interview with Mr. Murphy, fellow Irishman, was pretty awesome.
Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot, and he talked about things that, of course, I kept asking him about things that I liked. So, but he talked about a lot of things that fascinate me. So that was definitely very cool.
We didn't get a chance to hit on every single question, but, you know, when you're talking to somebody like that with years of experience in the field who has, you know, who's been on a ton of investigations and has a ton of theories, it's hard to really, get on all that.
That's right. Well, like you, that's how you are too. You have all those tons of years of experience. That's why I could pick your brain for hours, but I won't. If I become a zombie, your brains will be very delicious. So
it's delicious. creamy paranormal goodness.
Creamy paranormal goodness. Yuck. So clearly we're a little bit topsy-turvy in our show tonight. And we did that because Bill was kind enough to agree to come on with us, but he did want to be off by 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock out here on the coast. 10 o'clock on the East Coast, so that he could watch the mid-season finale of the show, and so that's why we're sort of a little bit backwards. But we do have the Ghost Gadget guy coming up a little bit later, too.
Great.
So that'll be in about 20 minutes or so, and I'm looking forward to that. He's going to be talking about inductive amplifiers and their use in paranormal investigation, also known as inductive probes, which I know makes you a little nervous, Rick.
Well, you know me, I always like a good probe.
You and Cartman, huh?
Why does everything today have to do with things coming in or going out of my butt? There
we go. So, hey, I wanted to tell you about, we went up to Wellington, and I know I haven't sent you the book yet. I will, I promise. Have I been promising this every week since we started the show?
You know what? I have so many books to read right now.
No worries.
So take your time.
Yeah. So Sunday night we investigated. Well, we don't really investigate up at Wellington anymore. We go watch other people investigate. We sort of just go and socialize, and Jim walks around with a gun and stuff because it makes him look like a man. And so we were up at Wellington with our friends from Northwest Paranormal Investigation, and then also our with some people from West Coast Ghost Hunters, and it was really cool because what was neat about it was to watch somebody else discover Wellington.
Right.
Because it's such a cool place, and I think that people sort of think, oh, I've got to go see this, but until you experience it, you don't really get what it's about. So, but anyway, I don't investigate very much anymore, but I go walk around, and, you know, we'll do things like play a little music and talk to the ghosts up there, but it's more of a social activity for us. So I was walking down the snow shed. We were all walking down in this big, large group, and my now 14. He turned 14 on Thursday. My 14-year-old son was right behind me. And I felt him pull my hair. And I said, Tanner, stop pulling my hair. And he said, well, I didn't pull it. And like four times I turned around and yelled at him, don't pull my hair. And finally Bert, who was walking behind him, said, he's not touching you.
Yeah.
So I don't know if my hair was caught in my sweatshirt or you know, if I was being messed with, but it was definitely an interesting experience. And I felt really badly. Tanner likes to remind me of what a bad mom I am because I accused him of pulling my hair when it wasn't him.
Yeah. Well, I feel that same way here, too, in Chicago about Bachelor's Grove. You know, everybody, you know, you always read a bunch of stuff about Bachelor's Grove and not a whole lot of people, you know, get to experience the place. But although I don't really feel that graveyards and cemeteries or whatever are haunted, there does appear to be a lot of energy in this one area. And it, you know, could be because it's a portal area opened up, you know, through satanic worship or, you know, orgies, God only knows. But yeah, I feel the same way about Bachelor's Grove. It's definitely one of my favorite places to investigate.
What do you think about portal areas? Because I hear that a lot, and I have never really experienced anything that I would term a portal, but maybe that's just because I don't know what I'm supposed to term a portal.
Well, a portal is, you know, of course, an opening that can be opened up. Some people think that there are naturally occurring portals, you know, in like a lot of Native American legends. Other portals can be opened up through the occult, or, you know, some people even believe that portals can be opened up with high levels of electricity. And it's through these portals that spirit beings, either human or inhuman, are able to come and go at will. We did an investigation here in Lake County where it was definitely a portal, and that portal was the front window of this family's front room.
I remember you mentioning that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we actually got an EVP, and my wife Jamie heard it as well. Where, you know, the guy says, the spirit voice says on the recorder, they want us to come in and out the window. Well, obviously, whoever you know they are, that I don't know, but I would definitely say that there was definitely some kind of, you know, doorway opened in that area.
So it's not like the TV on Poltergeist where, you know, you can get sucked in then.
No, absolutely not. There is a place though, around here in Burlington, Wisconsin, where, it's like a forest, and I've actually investigated it and found out that it's nothing but bunk. And, you know, they claim that this place is a portal where, you know, fairy creatures and can come and go at will. And, you know, it just turns out to be a way for, you know, this individual and, you know, their spouse to make money. I really don't think there's anything there.
You know, I think that's true of so many places. So many, and I think even some of the pretty famous haunts, I wonder how much are just hype. You know, I tend to be suspicious of any place with a gift shop, although, you know, I've long considered taking one of the outhouses up at Wellington and turning it into a gift shop. So, you know, just saying.
Well, you know, ghosts, monsters, whatever, are great money makers. And if you have anything like a restaurant or a hotel with, of course, you know, John Stone's in Massachusetts and, of course, the Stanley in Colorado, I'd have to say that those two have been investigated so many times and so much great evidence has come out of it. You know, it's hard to say that they're in it just to make bucks, and that's obviously not the case with them.
Yeah, well, and I certainly understand that there are some that aren't, but you know, I just wonder, because paranormal tourism right now is a big deal.
Right.
And I've been to a lot of places that just don't live up to the hype. And you start to wonder, wow, how much of this is just urban legend or made up for tourists or whatever.
Right. You know, I mean, if you can walk away from a place, for me, you know, when it comes to evidence, if I can gather just one electronic voice phenomenon where it is an obvious voice that's not mine or somebody that's with me, for me, that's enough to say, this place is haunted.
Sure.
But, if I walk away from there with absolutely nothing, and, you know, of course, you know, being slightly sensitive and all that, if I walk away from there with absolutely nothing, I'm just going to say, this place is not haunted. This, you're just trying to make a buck.
Yeah, yeah. So Cheryl is going to become a paranormal tourist here really soon, aren't you, Cheryl?
Yeah, I am. I'm excited.
So talk a little bit about it. What you got coming up?
Well, we have a trip to Waverly Hills Sanatorium coming up, and we're going to go with a group of about 13 or 14 investigators. Some have investigated before, and some, this will be their first time. So I count this as my first time. I have gone on those paranormal investigator tours that you pay for at the Queen Mary and at the Whaley House, but I don't really consider that true paranormal investigation. Even though we are paying for this overnight, it's going to be an 8-hour overnight investigation, we'll pretty much be on our own to roam around and investigate at the different levels of the of Waverly Hills. So,
you know, I actually recently heard that they were thinking about turning Waverly Hills into a hotel. Is that
yes.
true?
Well, last I heard, it was true. They were going through the process and getting whatever fundraising and permits they needed. And what I had heard and read was that they were going to keep one level strictly for ghost investigations or whatever you want to call it. But they were going to convert it into a hotel, a pretty nice hotel from what I read.
Well, I mean, so. unless you cleanse the place, or, you know, you help the spirits pass on, they could become easily, you know, part of the land that this new hotel is going to sit on, and, you know, these spirits could, if they're intelligent, are just going to run roughshod all over the guests and the people who work there.
Well, that's a great point.
yeah, but isn't that what people go?
Yeah, oh,
Are you going to go to a hotel with a haunted reputation and then just think, oh God, I hope I don't encounter a ghost?
Well, we go to hotels asking for the haunted rooms. So about the Queen Anne Hotel. We went and investigated a couple of rooms that we had there overnight, a couple of nights at the Queen Anne Hotel, and we stayed in the Miss Mary Lake room specifically because it had the most reports of paranormal activity, and we did encounter some interesting things there, so I would love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you don't get scared then when something out of the ordinary happens?
Me?
Unless it's a zombie.
No, I don't. It makes me curious. I want to find out why it happened, and I want to learn more about it. I don't usually get scared, no. But, you know, Waverly Hills, I hear, is very intense. It's a very intense location, so I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, Chad's been there before.
Yeah, this will be his second investigation there. So,
But do you think that boils down to expectation? You go there and you hear all these amazing stories about Waverly Hills Sanatorium, whatever, and you have that expectation, all right, I'm going to see a ghost, or I'm going to hear a voice, or, you know, something in the death tunnel is going to push me down. And I mean, how much of that is expectation, and how much of that is legitimate activity? That's what I wonder.
Right.
I do too.
Yeah,
I do too.
That's a great question. I guess when something happens, you just have to take notice of the environment and the surroundings and what might have caused it, and just make your best guess at what it could be.
Right. Yeah, and I just think you let yourself experience it fully, and once you've had the experience and, you know, cleaned yourself up afterwards, then you can sort of analyze it was.
The change of underwear.
You know, it's great if you can actually shut your mind off for a minute and let yourself experience it first before you start thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm hoping I get some time alone in the morgue. Or was it the morgue? The one with the drawers in it? The morgue drawers?
Was that at Waverly Hills?
Yeah.
Can you go in the drawers?
Yeah.
Oh, can you go in there?
No, you can't go in them, but there's a couple of roll-out or pull-out drawers that I think close, and I want to, maybe do an EVP session there alone. I don't know if I will, but maybe if I don't chicken out.
Oh, sorry, Karen, go ahead.
I was going to say, isn't one of the first rules of investigation that you never investigate alone?
That's
right. I'll have Chad stand around the corner. How's that? He can come and save me from the EVPs.
I was just going to say that I could. I mean, if given the chance, I'd probably spend an entire night down in the death tunnel, body chute, whatever. I mean, that place is just scary enough alone as it is, without the possibility of something unseen coming up behind you. You know.
Yeah. I wonder how much of it is claustrophobia in that death tunnel, though.
It could very well be.
Yeah. Yeah, I was listening really with a lot of interest to what Bill was saying about the granite.
Mm-hmm.
And the Stanley effect, is that what he was calling it?
Piezoelectricity.
Yeah, it was definitely very interesting to, you know, I've always sort of wondered about places with big granite deposits like that. Like, cemeteries have lots of granite too, so you wonder if some of that comes into play, or at a place like Waverly that's this big huge concrete building. It's concrete, well, right?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the old castles and manor homes over in Europe, Great Britain, and Ireland, whatever, a lot of these places are built from sandstone and rocks that are great, conducers of electricity. And a lot, the theory is that a lot of these places, they call it the stone tape theory, or as we call it over here, residual haunting, that it holds this information and then, explodes and pushes it out into the environment and, causing right. a haunting. So, I mean, yeah, that could very well be it.
So, Waverly Hills is definitely one of the ones that I'd like to go to, and unfortunately, I had the opportunity to go with these guys and couldn't afford it, but it's definitely on my list of places to go. I don't know. I have to come up with, like, a top five, I think. I know you've got a top five, Rick. Is your top five what you wrote about in the magazine this month, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, yeah. Totally. Yeah, I would give my left nut to go to the Villisca Axe Murder House. I think that's... one of the most tragic and sad cases of all time, that an entire family was brutally slaughtered by an unknown assailant. But at the same time, in my work in the paranormal, I don't just want to help the people who live in a location. I also want to help those that, have been stuck there somehow. And if I can bring, a rescue medium or something like that with, I would love to investigate it and, help those spirits move on to their next incarnation.
Chad just texted and said it's rickety and drafty. He did give his left nut. He only has one left now because he had to give his left nut to go. So, but he's been there. So Cheryl, you have a top five. What is it?
I do. Well, okay. Well, Waverly was on my top five, so I'm going to get to do that here coming up in a few days. And then Queen Mary was on my top five. And
well, look at you're living a dream, sister.
I have achieved the Queen Mary, although I'd like to do it a long overnight. The three that I haven't done in my top five that I'm really hoping to are Gettysburg, Villisca Axe Murder House, which you guys were just talking about, and the USS Hornet.
Hornet is one of mine. Yeah. Hornet might be my number one. Mm-hmm. Gettysburg would probably be my number two. And I'm not sure what my other three are. I don't know. I'd have to really think about it, because I kind of like going any place that has an interesting energy to it. So
exactly. Well, Eastern State Penitentiary sounds really interesting to me. That's up there, too, in the top ten.
Yeah, it's been done so many times,
Well, yeah, it has.
You know what's amazing to me is, even after all the time that I've done this, and the many times and where I've captured EVPs and things and heard things and smelled things, I still get excited about it. And that's what makes it so cool, is that none of this stuff has become commonplace. And Rick, you've been doing it since you're eight. Do you ever just get something and sort of think ho-hum, or do you still get really excited when you get that good EVP and that good piece of evidence?
I'm still like a kid in a candy store with it. I get so amazingly psyched whenever I go on an investigation. I personally prefer the dark stuff. I'm kind of like, Zach, Nick, and Aaron in that respect. I kind of like dealing with inhuman entities, and I still get really psyched over those.
Yeah. Well, I haven't been as many places as you, and done as much as you, or ever experienced anything like an inhuman or a demon or anything. But I get pretty excited too. Every time I meet up with a new paranormal group, I always tell them that, hey, you can take me on an investigation, because of course I don't have a group. I just follow people around who do. So,
well, do we have time so I could talk about, you know, something that, you know, I looked into when I was, I think I was maybe 19 or 20, where I actually took part in the binding of a demonic spirit.
Sure, go for it.
Do we have time for that? Well, it was like, it was a camping trip, and I worked kind of loosely with this woman who worked for Bob Larson Ministries. Now, I'm not a particularly religious person, but he does do some great work in the field of helping people get released from, you know, demonic energies or whatever. And I can't really give her name because I don't want anybody coming after me. But this was a young lady who has definitely had more than one, you know, negative energy involved with her. I would say that she had a multitude. And I actually was there while not really an exorcism, but more of a binding ceremony where they were trying to keep the demonic energies within and not allowing it to affect the physical environment and not allowing to to affect others around her. And I got to tell you this, whenever you see something like that and you look into the eyes of a person who is possessed by a demon, all you see is pure hatred. And I would have to say that it didn't scare me, but it did shock me a little bit.
That might scare me. That might scare me. That sounds a little bit intense. Definitely.
Yeah, it can be very intimidating, but you know what you got to understand is and what a lot of people don't understand about dealing with it in humans is that you really are it. No matter what your religious belief is, you as a human being, you walk on the face of the earth. You have a heart and a soul. You feel the sun on. You have more power than these creatures do. The only reason that people get so frightened, they become possessed, and they think, oh my God, this thing is trying to take over my world, is because they fall into the lie that this thing, because it is unseen and because it has, you know, certain preternatural abilities, that it's somehow greater and stronger than us, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, you know, you sort of know my take on demons, which is that I think that all of the demonic evil stuff is people, not supernatural. I think it comes from people. But I could certainly be proven wrong about that, because I've been proven wrong about many, many, many things in my life. Just ask my husband and son.
Oh, so have I.
Yeah. Hey, we need to go to break. And when come back, we're going to have the ghost gadget guy, Michael Kravchuk. So we'll be back in a minute.
Pause for the cause.
Hi, everyone. It's Karen Frazier at Paranormal Underground.
And I'm Rick Hale, Paranormal Underground writer.
We're here to invite you to explore the unexplained with Paranormal Underground Radio, live and on the air.
Join us every Thursday night for paranormal talk and great guests from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time on ztalkradio.com.
This is Karen Frazier, founder of the Namaste Project. Several months ago, I was really struggling with a number of people in my life. I got tired of being angry all of the time. One day I was driving home thinking about how I could stop being angry when the words, the Namaste Project, popped into my head. In that moment, I understood that every person, even the ones who made me angry, had a light of the divine in them, and if I could just find that light in every person I encountered, then my world would be a better place. The Namaste Project was born. Now I'm inviting you to join me. Visit namasteproject.org to learn how you can change your world. Change happens one person at a time. I hope you'll join me. That's namasteproject.org.
Station identification.
You're listening to ZTalk Radio Network.
Operating frequency.
On ztalkradio.com.
We're live, guys. Hey, guys. We're live. Hello. You guys are gabbing away. You guys were having such a good time that, you know, I felt
bad.
You're
both a couple of Chicago boys over here.
You're both a couple of Chicagans. So, Michael is with us, the Ghost Gadget guy.
Yeah, hold on. I got to go put down my beef. Hold on a second. So, there you go. How you guys doing?
He has to put down his what?
My beef. Rick would know. He'd understand.
It's
I know what he's talking about. Yeah.
So, inductive probes. Is that right? Is an inductive probe the same thing as an inductive amplifier, Michael?
I'm going to go by inductive amplifier because if I say 8-inch long white wand, probe, I'm going to have problems talking about that. So.
You're going to giggle. I got it. I actually have an inductive amplifier because my husband works in electronics, and he's put it in my little paranormal backpack several times, and I've always said, what the heck am I supposed to do with this? So you're going to tell me.
Yes, I will. Yes,
sweet.
I will. For those of you not in the know, essentially what an inductive amplifier is, it's a tool that's been used in the telecommunication industry for probably 20, 30 years now. And essentially what that tool allows, you know, your phone repairmen to do is they wire, and they can actually then trace that tone as it travels along a wire, or even if it's in a bundle of wires, it makes them real easy for them to find that one specific wire with that tone on it. And essentially what it consists of, it's about 8 inches long. It's just a plastic handheld tool. It's got a push button on it. And it's got either a plastic or a metal tip, and it's got a speaker that's on there that's probably about 2 inches in diameter or so. And essentially when you push the button, that's what, you know, triggers the inductive amplifier, and you can kind of, you know, hear the tone. What's really neat about these things and the way that they're really useful for paranormal investigations is you can actually hear EMF, which is cool. Mm. So how many times have you been to a location where, okay, you know, you'll take your EMF meter and you'll hold it up to a light ballast or something, and you'll see it spike. You'll hold it up to the refrigerator, you'll see it spike. But sometimes you may find an EMF source that's sitting there on a wall, not near anything, and you're going, huh, you know, okay, what, you know, is there electricity behind there? Where's this EMF coming from? Well, the neat thing with the inductive amplifier is you can actually, you know, turn this thing on. I've actually changed it out so that this way it's got a toggle switch on it, you know, real simple modification from Radio Shack. And you can turn this thing on, and you can actually hear if it's, your 110 electricity, because it has a specific buzz. And you can actually hear that buzz that the AC, you know, causes. And we've actually used this on several occasions to kind of debunk, if you will, different EMF sources. We were at one location where the homeowner swore up and down that the electricity, there were some investigators that were experiencing EMF on the stairs every so often, and the homeowner swore up and down that the electricity does not run up and down those stairs. It actually ran through the walls. Well, we were actually able to trace from one of the outlets, trace the conduit up all the way up the stairs and all the way up to where it went to the light switch up at the top. So, you know, that was a pretty easy debunk for us.
Yeah.
So, any questions so far?
No. What you're saying is very different than what I've heard somebody use it for before. So, keep going.
Yeah,
you know,
please.
And that's pretty much from a debunk standpoint.
Okay.
There's what a lot of people are starting to use this for now is essentially turning this thing on and seeing the same way that you would get a trigger with an EMF meter. Let's say you're doing your EVP session and you're going to say, hey, you know, if there's somebody here, you would like to talk to us, the same way where you may get a spike on your EMF meter. People are actually using this now, and they're actually getting responses on the
EMF. I've used for before. Okay, go on.
Yeah.
Now, you guys have heard of Andy Kopic, you know, Mr. MIT out in California. He's had a lot of success with this. And matter of fact, they were on the Queen Mary, and they had quite an expensive not necessarily a conversation, but it was almost a back and forth where they were asking questions, and this thing, the inductive amplifier kept getting louder in terms of its buzzing and almost reacting towards the questions. And it wasn't the same buzz that you would get from normal electricity.
Okay, so I'm in a haunted location. There's no electricity in this location, and I've got an inductive amplifier.
Uh-huh.
What do I do with it?
I would say this, normally how
quiet.
You do it.
I heard Rick giggle when I asked that. Sorry, go ahead.
You're trying to.
No, that wasn't me.
Okay.
You're doing your normal EMF sweep and trying to find, your sources if there's any EMF. Obviously, if you're in a location that has no electricity whatsoever and all of a sudden you start picking up EMF, if you're picking it up with your meter, you certainly think that you'd be able to pick it up with the amplifier. But I did have a real interesting occurrence. We were talking before we came on here about Bachelor's Grove out here in the south suburbs of Chicago.
Right.
We have to be out in, this is, the world-famous haunted cemetery, Bachelor's Grove, with the, the famous Madonna picture on the tombstone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the disappearing farmhouse and all that.
Yeah, exactly. And we, as a matter of fact, it's funny because we actually had, I had my Tri-Field Natural EM meter sitting on there, turned on. And obviously, Rick, if you've been there, there's no electricity anywhere near that place, right?
Oh, absolutely not. No way.
So I had that on, had the inductive amplifier turned on, and we were sitting there, we were asking some questions. Well, lo and behold, all of a sudden I started getting a pulsing on the inductive amplifier. And it was just a steady pulsing, and it only went on for about 5-10 seconds. It didn't go with any of the questions that I was asking. But the interesting thing was this, and anybody who's used a tri-field natural EM meter, those things are so flippin' sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
You'll pick somebody up, walking 20 feet away from it.
Yeah.
And the tri-field was picking up absolutely nothing.
Right.
And can't explain it. I can't say it was paranormal. It was just something that, I couldn't explain.
But when it comes to that, using that... could it be something that's, of course, natural, coming from the ground, electrical, natural electrical impulses coming from the shifting of the Earth's crust or whatever? I mean, could that affect that?
I think it probably could. And I think, this is just another tool to put in our tool bag there when we're going on investigations, because, there have been many occasions in which, we've had, our tri-field meters, or people have had their K2s, or whatever the case may be. They've got all their cell phones turned off. They've got all the electric turned off.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you're getting some sorts of EMF.
Well, right.
The nice thing with this is, this allows you to hear it, if you will.
Right. So, well, I think that if you can back up anything like that with EVP or, of course, a photograph or a video, I mean, that definitely adds credibility to... any tool that we may, have in our little, wizard's toolbox.
Sure.
So if somebody wants to get one of these, who makes them, who makes good ones, and where do they find them?
You can find them online. I mean, if you put in an inductive amplifier into your Google search, you're going to find them. Greenlee Textron is probably the main manufacturer of them. They're run anywhere from about $60 to $80. The more deluxe model, if you will, has a light on it that's actually nice, that as it picks up the sound, it'll actually increase the intensity of the light. So if you do the modification where you put the toggle switch on it, you can actually be in a dark room, kind of across the way, and if you're not hearing it on the speaker, you can probably actually, see that sound occurring across the room. So and then the way you're able to stand a good distance away from it, so you don't have any kind of effect. But it runs anywhere from about $60 to $80. You could probably find them on Amazon. Used, I've heard people out there tell me that they pick theirs up anywhere from $10 to $20.
Oh, you could probably build them yourself, right?
So, do you use them a lot in your investigations?
I use them the same way when we go to a location and we start doing our baseline readings. And again, I just want to make sure that what I'm picking up on our EMF meters is the same thing that I'm picking up, with the inductive pro, or, gosh, you guys got me saying inductive with the inductive amplifier. And, you know, and then when we do an EVP session, you know, I start, you know, you start thinking outside of the box. This is one of the things that we'll put out there, you know, along with, you know, various other items, and to see if, you know, who knows, you know, the same way that we're going to ask for, you know, ask questions and, hey, you know, can you make my meter spike? You know, can you make a sound on this little device here?
Yeah. And so it doesn't make any recognizable sound. It just kind of buzzes, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a buzz, but, you know, the interesting thing is this. If you get a strong enough audio source, such as a radio station, it'll actually pick up items like that. If you were near a radio tower, you'll actually start picking up that right through this inductor.
It'll talk?
Yeah.
It'll talk like...
Yeah.
Well, how about walkie-talkies?
You're probably going to pick up, you know, the same way that you would with your EMF meter, when you're going to get that spike of that initial burst, that's probably what you're going to pick up on here, too.
Okay.
You know, almost the same way, mm-hmm. you know, when you have your cell phone on and it's too close to a speaker or something like that, and you start hearing your cell phone buzzing on speak and whatnot.
I think that Andy, and Andy's in the chat room, and when he hears me, he can confirm this or not. I think that Andy actually posted on our website in our evidence section an inductive amplifier. I have to think about what I want to call it the other thing, too. So, but I think that he actually posted a session with that from maybe like the Queen Mary or something. So I don't know. But I do think that if you go to our website and you look in the evidence section, for anybody who's listening, we have the galleries. And I'm pretty sure if you dig through there, you'll find Andy's session with the inductive amplifier on the Queen Mary, which is a really interesting application. Like I say, Jim keeps putting it in my backpack, and I keep thinking, now what am I supposed to do with this other than carry it around? So I've never used it.
Yeah, two of the other modifications, and as a matter of fact, Andy's posted them, too, on a couple of the gear sites out there, you know, so that you could actually boost the pickup on this. And it'll be a little bit more sensitive, and then you can also boost the amplifier so that the sound is going to be a little bit louder. You know, you can also add a microphone jack to this, too, so if you wanted to plug it into a powered speaker, and you could hear it a lot better, too. You can make that modification pretty easy.
Right. Yeah, Andy's getting the link. So Andy will put the link up in the chat room of where that is if anybody who's listening wants to go listen to. It is in our gallery. Well, it sounds like an interesting piece of equipment. It sounds like it could be misused, though, as well on an investigation, just like anything else, just like the K2 or anything else. You would need to be really careful about what you were taking as evidence. Is that a correct statement?
Oh, I would agree wholeheartedly. The same way, you know, if somebody's using a K2 meter and they've got a cell phone on and they're sitting there and somebody's sending them a text message and they're going, "Dear God, look at it! You know, it's lighting up. It must be a ghost." You know, you're gonna get the same thing with this.
Well, you know, we actually had that happen with a K2 meter just recently, where somebody actually thought his cell phone was turned off, he thought, and yet at the same time, the cell phone was causing the K2 meter to spike, and the only thing that we could figure out is that the cell phone was still searching for a tower every once in a while, maybe, or something. So yeah, cell phones can definitely wreak havoc on things like that, can't they?
Exactly. And just like Rick said, you know, we've had the arguments about the K2s, and, you know, people will say, oh, you know, it's a cheap EMF meter, and, you know, but the same way that, you know, if you're on an island in the middle of the ocean and nowhere near any kind of electricity and this thing's going off, something has to be triggering it, right? And,
you know, I've had great results with the K2 meter. I've actually had, you know, question and answer sessions with, you know, with an entity with it, and, you know, they're definitely, I'm definitely on board with the EMF and whatever.
Yeah, I think it's a great tool, you know, and it's not that expensive. Like I said, you can find them used and or even discounted at a pretty cheap, you know, $20, $30, $40 probably out there.
Well, you know, I was just this weekend, I've always been somebody who's very skeptical about the K2. I just have never seen it work in a way that I couldn't come up with a reason, whether it was a cell phone sweeping for, you know, sweeping for a tower or something like that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, this weekend we had it, and of course the site that we investigate, there's no power. There's no power within a mile of the place. So mm-hmm. no power lines, nothing. It's just, it's a mountain trail. And we were standing there, and this K2 meter was seemingly responding to questions and what was going on. So that was, and then there was another EMF meter that was doing it at the same time. So it was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I definitely would love to, you know, get one of these inductive amplifiers and use one of those in our next investigation with MCPRG. I think that it would be a great tool.
Well, if you do, you're going to have to tell us about it.
Absolutely. You know I will. I just can't give you names and locations. Sorry.
No. Gosh.
You know what? It, in a way, it kind of makes me feel a little bit like a fraud because I'm not allowed to talk about those kind of things. But, you know, there's legal things that we deal with.
It's all right.
Okay.
Isn't it? It's okay, right, Michael?
It is okay.
Yeah, that's right. He's not a fraud. So I think you two Chicago boys should get together and do a little investigation somewhere.
I see it happening.
I see it. Yes, definitely. You know what, Mike? In fact, I'm writing down your number right now.
Very good.
And maybe you could even do something and do it either a little bit live for the show or talk about it shortly thereafter, if it's not something that Rick can't talk about.
Well, as long as it's, I mean, if it's not with MCPRG, you know, it's, or, you know, McHenry County Paranormal Research Group, you know, I think it would be okay.
I think so, too. Now, Michael, you have a group you investigate with, is that right? Or do you test the equipment by yourself? Or
No, I'm with a group, Confidential Paranormal Investigators, and we're located out of Hoffman Estates, Illinois, so northwest suburbs, and so we pretty mm-hmm. much, you know, we're all over the Chicago and suburban area of Illinois, and like to stay local, but you guys know you get one that's 2-3 hours away, and you got to go, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
That's right. Hey, Cheryl, do you have any inductive amplifier questions while we've got Michael here talking about them?
Well, just I was just curious. I was talking in the chat room to a couple of people about it, and how do you make sure? And gosh, I hope you didn't already cover this. How do you make sure that the other equipment around it doesn't set it off?
You know, that's actually a good question. Most of your gear that you're going to use, something like an EMF meter, should not be giving off any kind of electromagnetic radiation. But mm-hmm. you know, this is probably a really good tool to kind of, I guess, debunk your own equipment, if you will.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, mm-hmm. probably do a sweep around your own equipment and check to see, hey, you know, there could be something setting this thing off. The same way you asked the question about the walkie-talkies.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Hey, Michael, you mentioned the EMF, the Trifield Natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a lot of confusion among people about how to use those. Can you talk about that real quickly, how to best use those on an investigation and why a natural would be different than a regular?
Well, the natural is going to exclude any man-made sources out of it, or so it's supposed to. But probably the most difficult thing with it, as opposed to the other tri-field meter that's out there, you know, the gold tri-field meter, if you will, the one that everybody sees, you know, you can walk around with that one slowly, and, you know, it's a great meter, absolutely great meter.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the Trifield Natural is it is so darn sensitive.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's very difficult. You, if you're going to walk around with it, you've got to walk around with it very, very slowly. It's very sensitive depending on what mode it's in. It will pick up a person behind the wall if it's in, I believe it's in the electric mode. It's going to actually pick you up behind the wall.
It's going to pick up mode?
You know, you got to be careful with it. But, you know, the way we like to use it is turn it on. I'll actually put it in the sum mode, which will be the combination between both of them, both modes. And, you know, put it across the room. And what's nice about it is it's got the sound on it. so that this way, if it starts picking something up, it'll start buzzing. It's
right. Great.
And the nice thing, again, is the sensitivity on it.
Yeah, it is very sensitive. I have it has the magnetic mode. It has, is it called the electric mode? I don't have mine sitting right here in front of me. And then it has the sum mode, and then it has like a battery test or something. Is that right?
That's correct.
So you put it in the sum mode. So
I've been told differently, but I prefer putting it in the sum mode so that this way I'm getting a combination of both. And if I'm getting any kind of a difference in either of those, it's going to react to it.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, there's lots of different schools of thought.
Okay.
I've never worked with a tri-field meter, but I've always wanted to.
Well, I'm not sending you that, Rick. I haven't even mailed you the book, so, you know. If I promised you a tri-field meter, it's not going to be coming anytime soon. Hey,
that
you know
one's
what?
Never coming.
That's right. You know what I think it's time for, you guys?
Uh-oh. Lightning round.
Lightning round. Are you guys ready? Cheryl, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, let's go lightning.
I was born ready.
I heard that about you. Okay, so scientists say that by 2050, we may need to rely on artificial meat grown in vats to feed the world's population. You can tell just by the way I say artificial meat grown in vats how I feel about this, I would think. It totally grosses me out. I don't know why it grosses me out, because everything else we eat is artificial, but for some reason it grosses me out. So here's my question. What do you guys think about eating cloned meat that's been grown in vats? Michael?
I've got one word for you. Spam.
Yeah.
No, I don't. We've been eating that for years, so I don't think this is anything new.
At least you didn't say Soylent Green, right?
Oh, you took my answer.
Oh, Rick, I'm sorry. Okay, Rick.
Well, I was going to say, I got two words for you, Soylent Green.
Way to ruin it, Karen.
Damn, oh my gosh,
I'm so sorry. Would you like me to ask a Twilight question so you can redeem yourself later?
Oh my god, nah, just move on to the next question.
Okay, well, no, wait, Cheryl.
Well, I can still eat seafood, right?
What if they grow that in vats, too?
Then I'm going to be a vegetarian. That's it.
Well, what if they grow that in vats, too?
Soylent Green is people.
Soylent Green is people. Is people.
All right, you guys ready for the next one? Okay. I'm still grossed out. I'm not going to eat anything that looks like meat now. Oh my gosh, my iPad just went black. Oh, there we go. Okay. So, Stephen Hawking recently said that mankind must colonize outer space within the next century or face extinction. What do you think, Michael?
Boy, I keep coming up with smart answers here, but we had trouble capping an oil well at the bottom of the ocean here. I don't see us all getting on a spaceship and making it out to space anytime soon.
I don't necessarily think that's a smart answer. I think that that's a sad, sad observation.
Mm.
Really. Yeah. Rick, what do you think?
Well, unless he can actually build us some kind of faster-than-light drive, I would say by the year 2050, we're pretty much all screwed.
Okay. So that'll be in your child's lifetime.
Yeah, nice, huh?
Nice. Cheryl?
Well, here's the thing. I don't think we're going to get to outer space anytime in the next century, but, you know, we're still working on the moon and maybe Mars, but not in the next 100 years.
Yeah, but you know what happens when you try to colonize the moon. You saw the the time machine, right?
Yeah, they're working on it. I don't know. That's all I know.
Do you guys remember that show Earth 2 from a number of years ago that a group of people went and tried to colonize this planet that was similar to Earth? Am I the only one who watched that?
I don't recognize that.
I thought it sucked too, actually, but I was just asking if you saw it.
No.
They had Antonio Sabato Jr. or whatever his name was on it. All right. So A woman in Texas has won $20.4 million in the Texas lottery. Here's the thing that's unusual about it. She won that amount not in one jackpot, but by winning four different jackpots of the same lottery. Now, I think that that's probably virtually unheard of as far as odds go. So do you think that there's a supernatural element to this, or do you just think it's, you know, that she's lucky, lucky, lucky? Michael, what do you think?
I'm going to go back to the show number two for Paranormal Underground Radio and say it was the octopi that gave her the winning lottery number.
the psychic octopus.
It's the psychic octopus that picked the winner of the World Cup. So,
oh, could be. Okay, Rick, what do you think?
Hello.
There you go.
Oh, there we are.
Rick,
I was. I'm sorry. No, that's okay. I think the virtual impossibility are the Chicago Cubs ever winning the World Series. But, yeah, I think that definitely blows the law of averages right out the window.
Yeah, it does. Cheryl, what do you think?
Well, I think she's 100% psychic.
You think so?
Yeah.
So this is like she could win the James Randi Challenge then.
Well, she should try.
The not-so-amazing Randi.
You know, because people say, hey, if you're really psychic, why don't you guess the lottery numbers? Maybe that is it.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. All right. So a movie came out yesterday that I think Rick may be first one in line to go see. It's called Vampire Suck, and it's a spoof of the Twilight movie. Now, clearly, what this shows me is that there are large groups of people who don't like the Twilight Saga. And, Rick, I know that you are pretending when you say that you're one of them.
I am one of them.
I think that you secretly go to the Twilight movies, you hide in the back with your thing of popcorn, and you have read each of the books multiple times. So, here's what I want to know. Is Rick secretly on Team Jacob or Team Edward? Michael, what do you think?
In fear of jeopardizing my future investigations with Rick, I'm going to refrain from answering this question.
Good answer. Rick,
so, Cheryl, what do you think?
Well, I'll answer because I know the answer. And Rick cannot deny this. Rick is 100% a Team Jacob guy.
Because he hates Robert Pattinson's dirty hair.
Yeah.
No, you know what? I'm going to throw a third team out there. I am Team Christopher Lee. That dude was the best Dracula of all time.
Okay, I kid, Rick. I kid. I think that you are on Team Bella because, you know.
Yeah, she lives down.
Okay.
She's okay. Last question. So, a recent study found that today's movie superheroes are terrible role models for our children. Mm. According to the findings of the study, today's boys only have two choices in role models. They either can be a superhero or a slacker when they grow up.
Mm.
This disturbs me. I think that there's a third choice called human being, because there are people who exist in the real world. So here's my question for you. Do kids really have to turn to movie and television for role models? And do you really think that they're so impressionable that they can't distinguish between fantasy characters and real life? Michael.
I asked my 9-year-old daughter this right before we came.
Okay.
And she actually, believe it or not, her mom is her role model. There you go. So I guess we're doing something right, raising her.
Okay, Rick, what do you think?
I think that all the real role models, you know, of course, Buddha, Dr. King, Gandhi, they're dead and gone, but we could still look to them and their teachings and their way of life and, you know, look to them as role models. And I do think that young boys should not look to TV and movie stars and superheroes or whatever. They should look to these great examples of humanity.
Yeah, I think so. Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that kids do distinguish between fantasy and real life for the most part. You know, there are some exceptions. But I think that people look up to, you know, their family members, their parents. At least I think they do. But if they had to choose between the two fantasy roles, and I think it's sad that this story only gives you two, superhero or slacker, but I think they'd pick the superhero. I want to think that anyway.
At least there isn't serial killer, so.
Yeah, Good point.
Well, you know, and we have just a few minutes, and so this actually, when I was doing the research, because I actually researched lightning round questions, whether you believe that or not, and when I was doing the research for this, well, sometimes they come out of my head, and you can usually tell which ones those are, I think. Anyway, so when I was doing, what it made me think about was how there's kind of this argument as to whether kids can distinguish between video game violence and, like, real life. And there was a Penn and Teller Bullshit, which I think is an awesome show. It's one of my favorite shows. Mm-hmm. And they had this kid, because, and it was about video games, and they gave this kid a, I don't know, it was one of those big, huge military guns, and they took him to a range, and then they let him shoot it. And they said to the kid, now, wasn't that fun? Don't you want to do it again? And the kid was like, no. It was hilarious.
Well, anybody who shot a real gun is going to know it's, you know, if you don't have the strength to shoot it, it's going to take your arm clean off.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so, but I just, it reminded me of that and the fact that people think that kids are so stupid that they can't distinguish between video game violence and real violence. And, you know, I do think that they can. Maybe a few can't, but I think that if they have the right kind of parenting, they most definitely can. So, definitely. Cheryl, next week we have Shannon Sylvia, right?
We do. We have Shannon Sylvia back. She's been on our podcast twice before, and we always like talking to Shannon. She's going to talk about some of her current projects, as well as, you know, some of her theories on the paranormal and some of her previous history dealing with the paranormal. So we're excited to talk to her next week, too.
Cool. And Michael, give out your website for people who want to come check out all your gadgets.
That would be ghostgadgetguy.com. And my team is Confidential Paranormal Investigators at cpiteam.net.
Great. Okay. So next week, Shannon, Sylvia, and be sure to check out this month's issue of Paranormal Underground magazine, which is now up at paranormalunderground.net. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you'd like to be a guest on Paranormal Underground Radio, email editor@paranormalunderground.net. Until next week, keep exploring the unexplained at www.paranormalunderground.net and join us again next week for Paranormal Underground Radio on the Z-Talk Radio Network.